Thanks for tuning in to Dark Corner Media. By the way, we are also on YouTube, so if you like pictures instead of just listening, you can also do that. Just search for Dark Corner Media. It was Friday, January 28th, 2022 in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, that trucks began arriving in the city. It was the beginning of a weeks-long occupation of the capital city brought on by COVID legislation that was considered overreaching by some. They called themselves the Freedom Convoy. The next day, the 29th of January, thousands converge on Parliament Hill, the seat of the Canadian government. The protest? It's overwhelming for local law enforcement. The crowd is basically allowed to do as they wish while the city just sits back and watches. Some activities draw outrage from city officials, while police promise that investigations are underway. And while this weekend seemed to be the extent of the protest for many, the police, they were settling in for a long occupation. And it was then that the horns started. Air horns off trucks began ringing out at all hours of the day, and the convoy was digging in. There was no relief on the horizon. Not to mention the trucks that were sent out to nearby neighborhoods to create havoc with their horns and slow blockades. This peaceful protest was starting to feel less and less peaceful as the days stretched on. Residents near downtown complained of little sleep and how the constant horns were causing issues in their day-to-day. Mixing that with the uneasy feeling for residents when just leaving their house, there was a trauma seeping in. And almost a year after that month of occupation, people still speak of the PTSD, while the organizers and supporters of the event call them out for being weak. I mean, it's just a few horns, right? You can't be hurt by a bit of noise, can you? Or can you? Our brains react to sound. It's just hardwired in, from the soothing feel of classical music to the jarring sound of a newborn crying. Sound is closely related to emotions. Consider movies for a second. Your brain can actually tell what kind of scene you're watching, even with your eyes closed. Try it sometime. Take a horror movie or a psychological thriller, just close your eyes and listen. Guaranteed, you'll be able to identify different scenes. Also, the mood. A great deal of research and money goes into finding just the right music for just the right mood, including anxiety. But weaponized? Where is the line between annoying and actually being wielded as a weapon? If this is possible, let's set some boundaries for this. Now we're talking about the sound that can be perceived by the human ear. So this would include anything between 20 hertz and 20 kilohertz, barring any hearing loss. All other frequencies are off the table for now, just because that's a whole other can of worms. Also, we're only going to talk about the psychological impact of sound, not the physical effects. Early examples. One of the earliest uses of sound as a weapon may have to go to the Aztecs in their use of the death whistle. Now, there isn't a lot of information on how the whistles were used. In fact, when archaeologists started finding them around 30 years ago, they just passed them off as trinkets. Then finally, somebody caught on and decided to blow into one of them. And the sound was described as humans howling in pain. Also, the screams of a thousand corpses. Delightful stuff, that is. The problem is, historians can't accurately pinpoint what the death whistle was used for, considering the first one was found buried with the sacrifice victim. Now, it's not much of a stretch to think that it might have been part of the ritual. The general consensus among researchers is that the whistle was used at the moment of death to guide the souls into the afterlife. But there are many that still believe that the death whistle was also used before they all rushed into battle. Basically, any time there was death to be dealt. I would imagine, if that's true, the Spanish would have gotten an earful of this sound when they went to war with the Aztecs. Now just try to imagine. You're standing on a field. You're getting ready to attack, and you hear thousands of whistles that sound like women screaming in pain. First instance in war. Next up, we find ourselves looking at the Spanish Civil War. Hostilities broke out on July of 1936, and it was pretty much an all-around precursor to the Second World War. It was the Nationalists, or the rebels, versus the Second Spanish Republic, otherwise known as, well, the government. Interesting side note, Joseph Goebbels coined the term nationalist when he visited their secret delegation just prior to the war in 1936. And if you look at all the history books, these guys were the bad guys. It's kind of hard to argue considering they were aligned with the Nazis. On the other side, you had the Republic being propped up by the USSR. Now, 2 years into that war, the Republic was looking at ways to counter the absolute brutality being brought on by the Nationalists. Enter Alphonse Lorrain. He was a painter and an architect. He was commissioned to design prison cells that were meant to torture Nationalist supporters. And let's just say he was very, very good at his job. According to papers from his trial, the cells were built 6 feet by 3 feet. They had beds that sloped at a 20-degree angle so that they were almost impossible to sleep in. They had stones placed on the floor in a pattern that made it impossible to walk around, and the whole cell was adorned with art, with surrealistic paintings designed to confuse and distress. The lighting was pretty much used in the same manner, working alongside the art. But he wasn't done there. He also included a clock that ran too fast and a metronome that was amplified at different volumes and different speeds. This was called enhanced interrogation. And there is a lot of debate out there on the effectiveness of this type of torture. Some saying that it really didn't do much, but that's probably due to the fact that no one really paid much attention to it at the time. It was more of just a sideshow that was attached to the numerous other atrocities during the war. And you also have to remember, the concept of PTSD wasn't really a thing at the time. So what? You got yourself tortured a bit. Dust yourself off and carry on, soldier. But the most important thing about this story from the perspective of this video is it was one of the first times in recorded history that someone went out of their way to use sound as a torture device. Perfected for World War II. Now, shortly after this, the Nazis began discovering some negative impacts of music on prisoners. That said, when the Nazis began blasting music in their concentration camps, they weren't actually thinking of torture. According to them, they just wanted to, quote, educate all the prisoners on nationalism. Dachau concentration camp was operational long before the Second World War had started, opening their doors to political prisoners in 1933. Now, the original intent of that camp was to house inmates that didn't agree with the general public, mainly dissidents. But within a few years, the Nuremberg Laws were introduced and the camp kicked into high gear from the onset. One of the tools that was used was called re-education, and it involved music. Now, according to former inmate Walter Hornung, the camp commander Theodor Eich tried with all of his means available to teach the prisoners nationalist principles and to drive the internationalist ideals out. So to that end, Eich thought German music would instill the noble German values that were missing in the prisoners, meaning initially they didn't see it as torture. So what kind of music does a Nazi use to instill such values? Well, Eich's favorites had to be Richard Wagner, which does kind of actually seem odd on the surface, since Wagner was actually exiled from Germany for 13 years and considered a criminal. That said, he was most notably racist, or as they used to call it, a nationalist. So you had Wagner on repeat, and more people are piling into Dachau. Yet no one was catching on to the music being torturous. Then on Sundays, according to the survivors, guards would lead delinquent prisoners to a small house behind the guards' room. Music would be put on to drown out the sounds, and the prisoners would be systematically beaten. And this was the light bulb moment. The guards in the camp discovered that the music they were using was actually breaking the prisoners, so they expanded their use of it. Now, they went as far as forcing prisoners to join orchestras to perform Nazi songs, as well as SS folk and marching songs. And these were no small affairs. Some had over 80 members, and brass bands boasted upwards of 120 members. They weren't ragtag either. These guys had an impressive repertoire, including marching, music, dance, film, opera music, even some classical like Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And some of these bands actually started writing their own music. And well, let's just say that the Nazis learned how to use the music to indicate when certain things were happening. As you can imagine, the music was becoming a serious trauma to the prisoners at the camp, both the ones playing it and the others that had come to know exactly what the music meant. Chilean Revolt. We are still a long way away from the U.S. using Van Halen to get Manuel Noriega to surrender. That encounter is being credited with the U.S. ramping up their use of music in torture situations. But there was also plenty of history from them to draw on. On November 11, 1973, the United States helped General Augusto Pinochet take over Chile. And the newly installed government wasted no time in rounding up their detractors. The estimates are between 40 and 80,000 political opponents being seized and imprisoned over 1,000 makeshift prisons. Many didn't get that far either and were just executed on the spot. That said, there's still 1,000 people missing and presumed dead to this day. Now, executions were not the only form of control that Pinochet used. There are reports of 29,000 people being tortured, most of which in 1973 alone. Details came out in later years as some of the former prisoners began to speak out. Then along came Dr. Katia Chornick from the University of Manchester. She launched an investigation into the imprisonment and torture houses under Pinochet's rule. One thing stuck out for her, and that was the use of music. Victims told stories of loud music being played around the clock and during interrogations and torture. Apparently, it would be on repeat for days at a time. One former inmate tells tales of torturers that would sing to prisoners as they were being led to chambers, as well as during the process of torture itself. The belief is that the music was used to normalize the act of torture for the guards, but whatever the case, it worked really, really well. Most of the surviving prisoners point to the music as being one of the most painful memories. So then, what music did they use? Well, they had a soundtrack to Clockwork Orange, seeing heavy rotation, along with a selection of music from Julio Gladius and George Harrison's My Sweet Lord, which does seem like a bit of an odd choice. But at the same time, there are other songs that were written under the harsh conditions by the prisoners, and were actually recorded in secret in the camps where they were held. Even weirder though, you can actually purchase the soundtrack that they used for this torture. Bonus facts. As they were realizing the power of audio, armed forces started using it in standoffs. The surrender of Manuel Noriega, as I mentioned before, only took 10 days of sustained music to make it happen. The standoff in Waco, Texas, between the ATF and the Branch Davidians, included Tibetan bugle calls and Christmas carols. The leader of the cult, David Koresh, countered with Charles Manson's music. And of course, there is all the audio torture for Iraq and Guantanamo Bay, all documented as much as the government will allow, and we may have to wait a few years for those records to be released. Not too sure why the concept of weaponized sound is in any way controversial. I mean, we've all had that one person in our life that would scrape their utensils on a plate just to annoy you. But have you ever wondered if someone put a list together of the most annoying sounds ever? Well, yeah, Time Magazine did. And depending on how you look at their list, either vuvuzelas or Jim Carrey from Dumb and Dumber is the worst sound. Notable inclusions, I do have to add, Gilbert Gottfried, RIP good sir, dial-up modems, and snoring. And that list leads me to one thing I can't believe is not on that list. Now, it's not really torture, but perhaps capable of weaponizing it. Have you ever heard of misophonia? It also goes by the name selective sound sensitivity syndrome. Somebody likes their alliteration. Now, the name misophonia was coined in 2001 by a professor and a doctor in an article called Hyperacusis, an H word. Then it popped up in a peer journal in 2002. And in case you haven't caught on, it is the idea of a certain sound that will just drive you nuts. Now, I actually have this, and for me, it's mouth noises. Ugh. And in case you're wondering, there are no evidence-based treatments aside from avoiding people who eat cereal. Ugh.
What happens when we play outside? We become healthier, both mentally and physically. We become more creative and more focused. We connect with nature, each other, and ourselves. Let's Take This Outside, a new podcast hosted by me, Marianne Iveson, an aspiring outdoor athlete and nature lover. I speak to athletes, outdoor professionals, and scientists about their connection to nature, how it affects their performance and everyday life. Let's Take This Outside, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, and at letstakethisoutside.ca.